Does it work? I don't think it worked. Oh, yeah, it did.
Here.
All right. Welcome back, guys. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. And the projector's warming up, so we will please wait. Anybody have any questions about anything?
Can I say something real quick?
Hey,
real quick, in the doctor's opinion, when we were reading that paragraph and where we touched on restless, irritable, discontent, that's the internal condition that must be treated. The normal state of consciousness for an addict and alcoholic is being uneasy, easily annoyed with people around you in life situations, and having a sense of dissatisfaction with your own life and with the world in general. That has to be treated, and alcohol and drugs treated it for many years. Then we get to a point where they don't treat it, they actually make it worse. But we've already crossed that imaginary line in the sand. But the mind will tell us that one day it will be like it was. And that's the great delusion, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker and drug user. The idea that one day I'm going to be able to control and enjoy. That's just not a reality, but that's the delusion that we suffer from. The book also refers to it as an illusion. So everything that's in the 12 steps is designed to treat the internal conditioning, because that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontent is the breeding ground for the mental obsession. You guys follow me? That is the firing mechanism for what we're about to get into here a little bit after Bill's story. But the big book introduces it to you in Bill, in the doctor's opinion. It's really important because we're going to stress that a great deal here moving forward.
All right. Well, it's still searching. So if everybody turn to the table of contents. And we'll put this up here at some point, and then you guys can take notes if you want. I'm just going to run through it real quick. So, table of contents. From the preface all the way down to the forward to the fourth edition, those five sections, that's just general information. That's information about the fellowship. It gives the transparency to when they change things and when the stories change. General information. The doctor's opinion, all the way down to page 43. So that's doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there's a solution, and more about alcoholism. That's all the first step. So that entire 43 pages plus the 7 pages from the doctor's opinion, 50 pages is the first step. Now there's some other areas that the first step is identified. The doctor's opinion is the physical component. Bill's story's there for identification. There's a solution, which is chapter 2. Pages 17 to 23 talks about the physical. Okay? But then from page 23 all the way through to up to page 44, that's all talking about the mental. That's all talking about what the mental condition is that precedes the first drink. Okay? The chapter 4, which is We Agnostics, that's step 2. A whole chapter dedicated to step 2. So, are you starting to see that there's a lot of people within the fellowship that do not understand what step 1 and step 2 are about? Yeah. If they think that you just show up and you say, I want to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, restore me to sanity, 1, 2, 3, done. A lot more to it. How it works, chapter 5 is steps 3 and 4. Two steps devoted to one chapter. And then we've got this chapter 6, Into Action, which covers steps 5 through 11. So there's a ton of information in chapter 6. Okay, now working with others is obviously about sponsorship. And then two wives, the family afterward, two employers, and a vision for you. That is practicing the principles in all my affairs. So there's 75 pages of the 170 pages of the recovery portion of the book dedicated to the 12th step. And there's so many people within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that never make it there. Because they just don't make it there. So.
All right, got any questions?
And again, once we get the projector working, we'll put that up there. But.
Okay. We're going to go to Bill's story, page 5. Cocaine, alcohol, ceased to be a luxury. They became necessities. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day. 2 8 balls a day, often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my drug dealers or find myself paying off my bills at the trap house as if I had some. This went on endlessly. And I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently, or staying up all night having a psychotic break. A tumbler of gin or a handful of Xanax bars or Klonopins, followed by a half a dozen beers or a pint of liquor or some of a handle, were required if I were to eat anything that day. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety and clean time which renewed my girlfriend's hope. Skip the next 2 paragraphs. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as 1 hit of crack cocaine, not so much as 1 drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises. I'd made a lot of firm resolutions. But my girlfriend at the time happily observed that I meant business this time and we weren't going to smoke any more crack. And so I did. One thing about the big book, it is a textbook. You see how I just changed the words in the book? There's nothing that says we have to read this book verbatim. And so if I'm working with a cocaine addict, and he has no experience with alcohol, do you guys think I'm going to read the book as if it's about an alcoholic? I'm going to switch the book around so it addresses an addict. Because here's the deal. Let's say you are an alcoholic and you are an addict. And you're sponsoring a guy that's an addict. And you're reading the book as if it's being read to an alcoholic. And something in that addict's mind, the liar, will begin to tell him, this guy's not like me. I don't belong here. I can do this another way. It's very subtle, but it is there. And that's why identification is so key. But the identification, you know, it's the responsibility of the sponsor to know who he's sponsoring. And that's why qualification is important. And so to me, this is a beautiful progression of the surrender process. I woke up, this had to be stopped. I couldn't take so much as 1 hit, 1 shot, 1 drink. Have you been there? I bet almost everybody in this room at some point has been there. You had that moment of clarity, I can't do this anymore. I am wrecking my world. I'm losing everything that means anything to me. Anything that has any value is being stripped from my life. And for the first time, maybe the belief is finally being smashed that these substances are doing something for me. I get to wake up and I realize what they're doing to me. So this is a progression they're going to describe now. So now we're going to go to page 6. Paragraph 1. The remorse, horror, hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending disaster. I hardly leave the hotel room or my house, lest I collapse or see someone that I didn't want to see, or get hit by a truck, for it was scarcely daylight. A crack house across the street supplied me with cocaine all night. I had a bottle of Xanax bars. Writhing, my nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell or something horrible had happened in the world. Well, so had I. The world would recover, the market might recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a metal fog settled. Cocaine would fix that. Whiskey would fix that. So two slabs and oblivion. Right? This is a first step requirement paragraph for me. I remember the mornings. You know, for me, near the tail end of my addiction, I was having psychotic breaks all the time. I could have been diagnosed schizophrenic. I could have been diagnosed bipolar, manic, depressive, but because of, you know, it used to be I'd have to stay up for 4 or 5 days before I would lose my mind. Now I was starting to lose my mind after smoking for an hour or two. And the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning were happening all the time. Slowly, the progression towards being split wide open was happening for me. Slowly, I began to see that my mind was telling me to put an end to my life, but I was too much of a pussy to put an end to my life. I was a complete failure at living, and I was literally a complete failure at dying, because there was a part of me that had suicidal tendencies, otherwise I wouldn't be living that way. And so I continued down that path of fear and despair and bewilderment. Page 8. This describes what happened to me on the morning of November 5th, 2007. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter swamp of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Cocaine, crack cocaine, was my master. So the questions there are, have you been overwhelmed? What is your master? What do you serve? I am clear for me. Cocaine was my master. It told me, it directed me in every area of my life. My life was a big tunnel. At the end of it was one big crack rock. And nothing could get in the way of that. And that's how I lived between 2003 and 2007. I had this list of things I swore I'd never do, and I crossed every single one of them off that list for crack cocaine. This is why I'm so clear on my first step. And this paragraph drives it home for me, because I was alone, I was in despair, I was full of self-pity, I felt like I was drowning in quicksand, and for the first time, I had no answers, I had no ideas on what to do next. I finally became completely helpless and hopeless. And this is a good place to be, and this is a good place for Bill to be. Because he gets launched into recovery shortly after this experience. We're going to go to page 12. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. So I'm sure you guys, I know when you get in trouble here, you have to write Bill's story, right? Something like that. Isn't that one of the consequences here? Yeah. All right, so I'm not going to tell you the story of Ebby, because I'm sure a lot of you in here probably know it better than I do. But, Ebby is from the Oxford group. He comes and he 12 steps Bill. There's no 12 step at the time, but he tries to help Bill. And they're sitting at the kitchen table, and Ebby suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, "Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God?" Bill says, "That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required for me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would." This is a crucial point here that we have to discuss, because the foundation of the structure they're about to begin building in this book is the first step. That's why we've spent so much time tonight looking at the physical features. We're discussing now some of the mental features of this illness, because couple those two together and that's why you lack power. That's why you are powerless. You have a physical craving coupled with a mental obsession. Neither one of those is truly associated with why your life is unmanageable. When you're here in a place like this, yes, the addiction and the unmanageability are closely related to substances. The longer you stay away from a drink or a drug, you're going to discover what the real problem is, and it's an internal condition that's broken. So Bill here becomes willing to believe there's a power greater than himself, because he gets to create the conception. And he can work with that. There's a starting place for that. And so you don't have to have a conception of God for God to begin working in your life. You don't have to figure God out. You don't have to comprehend or define. All you have to become willing to believe is there is something, a power that you can access that can recreate your life. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Okay.
So, kind of rewinding a little bit through Bill's story, there's a lot of... They smash some of the jingles that we hear in parts of Bill's story. You guys don't have to go to it, but on page 4, he talks about the papers reported men jumping to their death from towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. Right. So Bill's at this point where, in Bill's story, they capitalize words that are God. Okay. Tsar, the heaven, spirit of the universe, those are all capitalized. And this paragraph, the middle paragraph on page 4, high finance is capitalized. Okay? So Bill's... I'm playing because it was flashing up. Bill's God at this point was high finance, money. That was Bill's God. And he's talking about this fact that these people are jumping to their deaths, and he's just like, these guys are losers. Well... When you go back to the paragraph that Tarek read on page 6, you know, we're 2 pages later, a little bit further into Bill's story, and he's asking himself, should I kill myself? Myself? No, not now, right? 1 paragraph later, his mind's changed. And he says, again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself weakly, right? So this thing, if you don't believe it's a progressive illness, you dissect Bill's story and you see how it's just getting spiraling out of control. From one point where he's judging people because they're jumping to their death, to the point where he can't figure out why he can't do it himself. And then, you know, on the bottom of page 7, it's talking about Dr. Silkworth talking to his wife, saying that she would soon have to give him over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I almost welcomed the idea. So at that point, when a person doesn't care to live, there's kind of no hope for them, right? And so fear sobered me for a bit. Where are we at? Back on page 8, it talks about how fear sobered him for a bit, right? In the middle paragraph. And we hear all the times in the rooms that you know, fear's a good thing. Fear's going to keep me sober. Fear sobered me for a bit. I'm sure I'm going to talk about it a little bit tonight. The fear of dying sobered me up for 4 days. That's it. That's all I got. Wanted to kill myself, live through the experience. Got 4 days. That's all it was good for. So fear doesn't have any use for me in my life today. Down at the bottom of page 9, it talks about he had come to pass. No, that's not what I wanted. I'm sorry, it's on page 7. Talking about how I went to town regularly when he had one of his lucid intervals, he went to town regularly and even made a little bit of money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Okay? Self-knowledge. Anybody ever heard of a trigger list? Trigger lists ever keep you sober? Because my triggers include oxygen. My trigger includes breathing and dealing with people. So I have to find something that's going to treat that internal condition. She didn't hit this, right?
So,
what's that?
Do what you'd like.
So at the bottom of page 12, the paragraph, "The real significance of my experience of the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I needed and wanted God." Okay? Did anybody have any sort of spiritual experience in their existence where they really felt the presence of something that was overseeing them, taking care of them? Did it keep you sober?
No.
So the key here is to feel that, to get that, and to develop a conscious contact or relationship with that thing. Because there was years ago, a couple years before I finally was struck sober, where it was the first time that she threatened to kick me out, and we went to this week-long marriage counseling intensive thing that was God-centered. And I remember walking out on this long bridge out in the middle of this lake and the stars and just the beauty of it all and feeling this presence of God. That's really the first time I really felt it in my entire life. And I'm you know, in my mid-30s. And we were in Missouri. And somehow between Missouri and Atlanta, that experience left me and it never came back. And I went back and did the same things that I was doing before then. So having a spiritual experience isn't enough to just get you there. You have to actually develop that relationship with it. So it goes on to through here in the next paragraphs, starting at the first full paragraph on 13. It says, "At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I was showing signs of delirium tremens." Okay, so here Bill goes in and starts really explaining the steps and what he did and how he went through them. So there in the hospital, he humbly offered himself to God, as he then understood him, to do with him and to do as he would. So that there we're in steps two, right? "I placed myself unreservedly in his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins," that's step four, "and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch," 6 and 7. "I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies," step five. "We made a list of people who I had hurt and towards whom I had felt resentment," 8 or 4, "and then I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals," 8, "admitting my wrongs. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right such matters to the utmost of my ability," 9. "I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly in doubt, when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I receive, but in that would be great measure." They're talking about 10 and 11. So the 10th step is where we where we finally get this conscious contact with God. And so it goes on to say, "My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living, which answered all my problems. So I like how Bill is very precise in his words. He doesn't say, I would then have the elements of a way of living which would answer all my problems except the ones with money, except the ones with relationships, except the ones with my wife, except the ones with finding a job. He says all my problems. And so there's a question in there. Do you believe that you would have, if you do these steps, that you will have the elements of a new way of living which will answer all your problems? Because I can tell you that if you say no to that, then you have a very limited God. Your God does not have enough power, and you need to find a new one. You need to find a God that is all powerful, that can do anything. Because if you don't have that belief in it, you know, I believe in that. And I have experience that shows me that if I don't believe that the steps are going to work, they won't. If I believe that the steps will work, they will. If I don't believe that God can help me with my finances, God's not going to butt in. He's not going to help me with my finances. But I can tell you from my personal experience, when I finally got to another surrender as it relates to finances, and my prayers are quite different from a lot of people that are very that have a very formal relationship with their God. My prayers sound something like this: God, I can't fucking handle this shit. You take care of it. And you know what? God doesn't care. He takes care of it. Is my prayers come in all sorts of forms with my God, and the relationship that I have with my God is a lot like a relationship I would have with a friend. And we can talk that way, and a lot of them are short, and I tell them to go fuck himself and change something, and that's okay, because God's just God. And he's like, oh, whatever, you're just upset. It's like one of my kids yelling at me when they can't find something. It's like, alright, so you know, that's how my God is with me. So belief in a power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order of things were essential requirements. Simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all.
All right.
Let's at least hit this.
Yeah. I want to continue. Simple but not easy. A price has to be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. Now, self-centeredness doesn't mean I think too much of myself or I think too little of myself. It means Tarek thinks about Tarek too often. That's what self-centered means. I got me on my mind all the time. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light, another spiritual term that Bill uses, who presides over us all. So here's this next paragraph, guys. I'm going to break this paragraph down because this paragraph has a checklist for things that must happen to you somewhere along your journey. Now, for Bill Wilson, they happened all at the same time, and that's why he had this white light experience. I and Brandon, both of us, have had every single one of these things happen to us in our recoveries. These are revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. So the question is, have I felt electric in this process? And the answer is yes. There is a sense of victory. I have felt victorious, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had ever known. I have felt greater depths of peace and serenity I didn't even think was possible before this process. Utter confidence in great measure. This is absolutely doesn't even compare to the way I lived and existed prior to this process in terms of confidence. Felt lifted up, absolutely, like a great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. I have man, I have tasted, I have touched, I have sensed this conscious presence at a level that I don't understand at times. God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. And tomorrow night, you know, when I tell my story, I did have a sudden and profound experience as part of my journey. And I am very grateful for that. But I think these items in this paragraph must happen to you if you are to live long and happily in this world in a recovered state. I want to skip down. So Bill talks about his friend, and then he continues to talk about this idea of helping all these suffering alcoholics. And then he remembers, my friend emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly is it imperative to work with other alcoholics and addicts as he had worked with Bill. Faith without works is dead, he said. How appallingly true for the addict and alcoholic. For if an alcoholic or addict fails to perfect and enlarge his or her spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, they will not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Certain trials and low spots. If they do not work, then they're surely going to get high or drink again. And if they drink or get high, they surely die. Then faith would be dead. Indeed, with us, it is just like that.
So are you saying that there's going to be certain trials and low spots ahead, and that when I get sober, it's not going to be all happy all the time?
I think that's what they mean by that.
Oh.
Oh. Okay. That's what's going to happen. The trials and low spots are coming, my friends. They are coming for each one of us. And I've had many of them in my recovery. And I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow night. But what I want to emphasize right now is very little about my character changed in those first 18 months. I wasn't demonstrating these principles in all my affairs, so I began to suffer in recovery. And it catapulted me back into the work. And then I woke up, and that progressively began to get better. Now, at almost 9 years clean and sober, my spiritual condition is based on how I'm practicing principles in my affairs. It's not based on how many times I pray and meditate. It's not based on me and Brandon coming down here this weekend. It's not based on how many meetings I'm going to. It's not based on how much serenity I have in my life. It's not based on my health or my physical fitness. It is completely based on how I engage with you. Can I practice these set of principles as I engage you? Do I play well together? Do I play well with others? Can we hang out in the same sandbox? That's what it's about. It's taken me many years to understand that. That's how I measure whether or not I'm fit spiritually. And then this sentence about the addict and alcoholic failing to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, it smashed when I read it, because they hid it from me, because it was not in this book for the first 6 years of my recovery. I did not see it that way. Right? I don't know how I read that sentence, but it wasn't until about 2.5-3 years ago. I'm listening to one of my heroes, this guy named Don Pritz. He's gone, he's passed away, and he's talking about it. And he says, God bless those big book thumpers. They really think them doing the steps and doing the works is the actual work. It smashed it. Because this sentence says that the real work and how we grow spiritually is when we take people through the steps. Me working the steps makes me a hollow bone. It makes me an effective channel. I can bring current experience with the steps to the person I'm sponsoring. I don't have to refer to a 9-year-old process. I refer to a current process. I just wrote a current inventory. I'm much more effective. I can touch them. I have more to pull from. And when I touch someone and I watch them change and I get to witness the regenerative power of God, it wakes me up. I get caught up in that exchange and I grow spiritually. We both do. That's what this is about. That's how I perfect and enlarge my spiritual life, through work and self-sacrifice for others. And, you know, maybe I can retract this statement, because Brandon and I have sacrificed a little bit to come down this weekend and carry this message to you guys. But it's another level when it's one-on-one. When you're sitting across the table and you see the psychic change and the personality change happen. And Brandon and I have been fortunate enough and blessed where we watch this happen in a lot of guys' lives that are around us. We may not have sponsored them directly, but we become part of their lives because we don't believe in just having one sponsor and that's your go-to guy. We believe in having different teachers, having a family that we go to. And we get to watch the regenerative power of God. And for some reason, when you witness the power of God, you get closer. Your awareness of it expands. And that's what this is about, expanding our awareness of God. And we're going to stop there, and then we're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we'll have our speaker meeting.